Well, I can't help but say, I'm back. I think Ken used that a few months ago, so I just wanted to try it again, try to use it. It worked. Thanks for that reassurance. Okay, Children's Church is going to be starting, and I guess, well, I see Allison and Grace headed towards the back. So if you've got children that you'd like to participate in Children's Church, you can send them out with them, and I assure you they'll take wonderful care of them, and they'll be back to visit us as I get wrapped up. I want to thank you for being here this holiday weekend. Members, our regular attendees, and visitors alike, especially if you're visiting, we thank you for choosing to spend part of your holiday with us. Now, when Kevin is going to be the one speaking, we can usually tell that he's the one who's going to be speaking. He's got on a tie and a coat. I travel incognito. No tie, no coat. That way you can't tell whether I'm the speaker or not. And I'm not going to tell you how to tell. So I apologize if I sound like I've got this head cold. I've now been battling it for about a week and a half, and I can't seem to shake it. So I apologize for what I sound like. Now, it might work to your benefit, because I did lose my voice for about a day earlier this week. So it is possible that that'll happen again, in which case, then you get to benefit from it. All right. Well, we're going to talk about Obadiah this morning. At 21 verses, if anybody has gone to do the comparative work, it is the shortest book in the Old Testament. However, as the phrase goes, don't judge a book by its cover or its length. There's a lot of ground covered in those 21 verses. As most of the books of the prophets, it begins with warnings about what's to come, about what wrongs may have been done, what wrongs they're going to do, and Obadiah is no different. The first 14 verses detail the mistakes of Edom. They didn't just make mistakes. Their mistakes were so significant that it resulted in God's judgment. They worked with the Babylonians and plundered the communities and towns and villages surrounding Jerusalem. Now, rather than my spending all the time detailing Obadiah, what I'd like to do is to show the Bible Project video on the book of Obadiah. It's way more enjoyment than listening to me for those 5 minutes.
The book of the prophet Obadiah. This is the shortest book in the whole Old Testament. It's a mere 21 verses. And at first glance, it does not look very promising. It's a series of divine judgment poems against the ancient people of Edom, which was a nation that neighbored Israel on the other side of the Dead Sea. However, there is way, way more going on here. So, first, here's the backstory. The people of Edom were unique because they had a shared ancestry with the Israelites. They both belonged to the family of Abraham, who, with Sarah, had their son Isaac, who, with his wife Rebekah, had two sons, Jacob and Esau. Now, the book of Genesis told us the story of these two brothers, and to say the very least, they had a tense relationship. They each later received the names Israel and Edom, which eventually became the name of the families that descended from them. And these families replayed the same difficult relationship of their ancestors. Israel and Edom had enormous tensions throughout the centuries, but they still shared that family bond. And it's that bond that was betrayed and shattered in the tragic events of Jerusalem's fall to Babylon. So when Israel was invaded and conquered by Babylon, the people of Edom took advantage by plundering other Israelite cities and then capturing and even killing Israelite refugees. Now, in other prophetic books, God held Israel's neighbors accountable for this kind of violence. And so here, Obadiah does the same for Edom. The short book has two halves. The first part is a series of accusations against the leaders of Edom, specifically for their pride and self-exaltation. Literally, as they lived up high in the desert rocks, but also metaphorically, they truly believed they were superior to the Israelites. And it's that pride that led the Edomites to not just stand idly by when Babylon came to destroy Jerusalem, but actually to participate in the destruction. And so God says through Obadiah that Edom will be brought down from their height and destroyed. As they have done to Israel, so it will be done to them. Now, right when you think you're going to hear more about how Edom will meet its doom, the topic suddenly shifts in verse 15. We hear this, "The day of the Lord is near against all nations." Now, why do we all of a sudden shift from Edom now to all nations? This verse is a hinge piece, and it links the first half of the book to the second half, where Obadiah announces the day of the Lord, but not only for Edom. He widens his focus to include all nations. And Obadiah says that all prideful nations that act like Edom will face God's justice in the same way. They'll fall from their prideful heights and come to ruin. Now, the combination of these two sections, one about Edom, the other about all nations, shows us why Obadiah was so interested in this tiny southern neighbor of Israel. Obadiah sees Edom's pride and fall as an example, an image of how God will one day confront the pride of all nations and bring about their fall, too. It's hardly coincidental that in Hebrew, the word Edom, or Edom, is spelled with the exact same letters as the word humanity, or in Hebrew, Adam. In Obadiah, Edom's rise and fall is a parable of how God's justice will one day oppose pride and violence among all nations in the day of the Lord. But as in all the prophets, God's judgment is never his final word. Specifically, remember the conclusion of the two books that came right before Obadiah, Joel and Amos. Joel had painted a picture of what will happen after the day of the Lord against all nations. He said that God would perform a new act of salvation in Jerusalem, and that all who humbled themselves and called upon him would be delivered. And in the conclusion of Amos, he said that after the day of the Lord has judged Israel's evil, God would raise up the house of David and build a new kingdom for Israel that would include Edom and all the nations called by my name. And so the book of Obadiah has been placed right after Joel and then Amos to expand on these very promises about the hope of God's kingdom over all of the nations. And so the book concludes with a very hopeful future. God says he's going to restore his kingdom over the new Jerusalem, that he'll repopulate it with a faithful remnant. And then from there, God's kingdom will expand to include all the territory and nations around Israel. And so this little book contributes to the larger portrait of God's justice and faithfulness that we're seeing in the prophets. The ancient pride and betrayal of the people of Edom becomes an example of the greater human condition, all of the ways that we betray and hurt each other and God's good world. But there's hope, Obadiah says. Edom's downfall points to the day when God will deal with evil in our world, but also bring his healing kingdom of peace over all the nations. And that's what the book of Obadiah is all about.
So that did way better than I was going to do. So as we see, Obadiah ends on a high note. It ends with a positive. What I want to do is to spend some time now to deal with that part in the middle to get us to that high part. So, first question, have you ever encountered something that was broken? I certainly have. Matter of fact, I'm going to say I know a thing or two about dealing with broken things. I'm sure many of you know that I live on a horse ranch. Now, if you've had the opportunity to live on a ranch, a working ranch, or a farm, you know that broken things are just part of life. It just seems like always something is broken. It's usually just a matter of how broken it is. Can you still get use out of it? Or does it have to be repaired before you can do anything? I might have wished I understood this idea of broken things on ranches and farms before I decided to operate a horse ranch. However, I didn't. So now I live with that. But there's a principle involved here. And we're going to talk about this principle more than once this morning. When we make choices, when we make decisions, there are things that come as a result of those choices, those decisions, sometimes those mistakes. Our choice to operate a horse ranch means that I get to deal with broken things. When things break, I either repair them, get somebody else to repair them, can't always afford to replace them. Can it be frustrating? Sure. But we work through it. It's part of the deal of our life that we chose to have a horse ranch. Another great example, and in my work brought this really into focus for me. Some of you may know that I was involved in aviation for 30 years. Now, when I say involved in aviation, no, I didn't get to fly airplanes. I didn't actually get to work on the airplanes, but I did get to spend a lot of time with the people who held the certifications to do the repairs on the airplanes. My role was designing and developing the software that managed and tracked the materials and parts and the repair processes for airplanes. Now, wrap your mind around this fact. On a wide-body aircraft, there are about 6 million pieces on that airplane. Those 6 million pieces have to be tracked, have to be accounted for. So there's a lot of tracking that goes into that process. Sorry, I can't help myself with this one. What are 50,000 parts all spinning around in a circle? There's more than 50,000 in the engine. We say it's a helicopter. The people who fly the helicopters don't always find that as funny as we did in the parts business. Aircraft repair is an amazingly complex process that requires tracking every single part that's removed from an aircraft and where it goes. It involves tracking every single part that went on an aircraft. Where did it come from and where did it go on the aircraft? Airplanes have lots of repairable or overhaulable parts. Think about your car. Have you ever replaced an alternator or a pump and you've gotten the overhauled pump, the overhauled alternator that you installed on your car? Same principle involved, except bigger and more expensive. And there's probably not paperwork that said where that part for your car was last installed and how long it was on and what had happened to it, as there is with an airplane. Mistakes on airplanes can be catastrophic. We've seen a lot of that in the news of late. I know that every time one of those mistakes gets made, I can't help but check just to make sure that something that my team did was not involved, that we failed to track a part, we failed to track a process. No, everything has been good for us. So, some parts on an airplane have to be taken off and inspected, repaired, and overhauled at certain intervals. Whether that interval involves operation for a certain number of hours or a certain number of takeoffs and landings, or what would be called cycles. Now, much like aircraft, you're probably wondering what that has to do with anything that I'm going to talk about. Much like aircraft, we should be examining ourselves from time to time, examining to be sure we're functioning properly. If we can see any opportunities to improve our functionality, then there's an opportunity to ask God for help, ask for prayer before we become something that's broken. I've heard it said, we live in a disposable society, meaning when something breaks, throw it out. Well, I want to encourage you to look at individuals. Don't look at them as disposable. Look at them as repairable. Look at them as improvable. Look at them as somebody in need of the great repairman. I assure you, God specializes in fixing and repairing broken things. So, how does something get to the point that it's broken? Let's take a look at how that gets to be that way. And I think there's probably two courses that get us there, and that's mistakes and illnesses. Sometimes illnesses or mistakes can lead to needing repair. So, and you don't have to show hands to these questions. You'll find out why in just a second. Have you ever been ill and wondered when you were going to feel better? I have. I'm going through that right now. The doctor says I could have another couple of weeks to deal with this head cold. I had to ask him, you got any other good news for me? Have you made any mistake and you wondered, what do I do next? I have. Have you ever wondered what God thought about your mistake? I have. Now, if anyone can honestly answer no to any of those three questions, please see me afterwards. I want to learn more about how you're living your life, because you've got a secret that we could bottle and start selling. So first, I want to suggest that an illness is something you don't get a lot of choice about. An illness can be caused by a mistake. For example, not bundling up in the winter, you can get a cold. Not taking prescribed medications can cause problems for your body to deal with. About 15 years ago, I got the real nasty influenza A. Now, I don't get a flu shot. My doctor at the time, I could kind of hear him, you know, rubbing his hands going, "We've got Scott now." I recovered from it. My doctor saw this illness as a result of a mistake. Come the next season, my doctor said, "So, Scott, you're going to get a flu shot?" I said, "No. Once in 50 years doesn't create a pattern for me." He wasn't very happy. Second, I'm going to suggest that a mistake is a decision we make that leads to a limitation. Boy, that was much easier to say when I said it quietly. When the Babylonians attacked Jerusalem, the Edomites chose to join in the plunder of the areas surrounding Jerusalem. They captured and killed people. When we make mistakes, there are likely results, some might say consequences. The Edomites were subject to God's judgment and were essentially eliminated. Some mistakes can have dire consequences, as in the case of the Edomites. If the Edomites knew what the consequences were of their mistake, do you think they might have made that same mistake? My grandson once had a car without a working fuel gauge. You can probably guess where this story is headed. Now, he knew how many miles he could drive on how much gas. He knew that, and so he knew to pay attention. Well, one time he made a mistake. Didn't put gas in the car after he got to that number of miles. The result was he ran out of fuel, and the consequence was he needed to call for help. And to this day, he gets reminded of his mistake. So, lesson learned. But sometimes those lessons can have consequences that live on for a long time. Do we learn lessons from our mistakes, or do we keep making the same mistakes? You know, there's another lesson that I want to bring about mistakes. And that is, perfection or believing you're perfect can also be a mistake. Wrap your mind around that for just a moment. That perfection can be a mistake. How can perfection be a mistake? Sometimes we try so hard or put so much effort or put so much pressure on ourselves to get it right that it becomes a mistake. I had a boss once to tell me to speed, please, Scott, speed up, make some mistakes. Perfection is not where you're trying to get to. We'd much rather fix some mistakes and allow everybody to learn from the mistakes than continuing to put pressure on yourself. So now I want to talk for a moment about avoiding mistakes. Well, the first thing that we get to do in avoiding mistakes is learning from past mistakes. If you make it once, try to avoid making it again. Now, sometimes that process and a mistake can involve saying something or doing something that's not the best. Has anybody ever heard the idea of counting to 10 before you say something or before you do something? Think about that, giving yourself a chance to measure your response. There was one time I lost track, and I didn't think to look how long ago it was. But do you remember the bracelets that people wore that said WWJD? Do we know? You remember what that was? What would Jesus do? So we can stop and think about before we do something and go, what would Jesus do in order to avoid some of those mistakes? Now, I concede mistakes are going to happen. Trust me. Illnesses are going to happen. So that's why we've got physicians and repairmen in our world. Physicians to help fix our illnesses, repairmen to help fix things that break. But I want to take just a moment and look at physicians and repairmen. So what's the difference between a physician and a repairman? Can we agree they both fix things? Yep. Good. At least I got a head nod out of the physician. I was going to be worried if I got a frown out of that one. So both have special training. That doesn't mean a physician's going to repair my tractor. That doesn't mean my tractor repairman is going to diagnose my head cold. The human body is infinitely more complex than my tractor. Yet to me, the tractor seems more complex. You have to understand, I'm not very mechanically inclined. I can probably understand cold medicine better than I can understand my tractor sometimes. So we get the assistance of the right person to get us through a problem. Now, I'm not sure that the idea of a repairman existed in Jesus' day. They had physicians. They had people who treated illnesses and sicknesses. They had tradesmen in those days. What was Paul? He was a tent maker. What was Jesus trained as? A carpenter. So tradesmen were part of the life in that day. So if you got a rip in your tent, you could probably call Paul. If you needed wood replaced in something, you could call a carpenter. But they didn't have the internal combustion engine in tractors were a long way off in the future, so they didn't really have repairmen to work on those things. So, physicians treat illnesses of our physical body. When we're ill, we need a physician to look at our symptoms, recommend a treatment, and bring us back to physical health. A physician likely needs to see us to make a proper diagnosis and treatment. The same is true when we make mistakes or feel broken. We need the great repairman to guide us to a solution, to guide us back to spiritual well-being. However, visiting the great repairman is much simpler than visiting a physician. He's got 24-hour a day, 7 day a week, 365, well, this year, 366 days a year office hours. You don't ever pick the phone up and call and get the answering service. He's always there to hear our prayers, to hear our requests, hear our needs. Now, so I've talked about illness, I've talked about mistakes, talked about physicians and repairmen. However, there's another attribute I just want to touch on because I think it can be sometimes more damaging. Sometimes the people around us give us labels and give us names. Those labels and names can be so very hurtful. But some of the most hurtful labels and names are those that we give ourselves. When we assign one of those labels to ourselves, only we silently see the label. That label gets to eat at us when nobody else can see what it's doing to us. When we make multiple mistakes, others or ourselves can think that we're broken, we're irresponsible, unrepairable, unwanted, or beyond hope. The name eats at us, and we can come to believe something that is just not true. Don't let Satan lie to you and give you one of those names. Don't believe in that name. It's just simply not true. God wants to repair you. God wants you to have a name change. He wants you to have the name change to rebuilt, repaired, redeemed, or restored. And I'm sure we can come up with a whole list of other words to go in there. Sometimes we see ourselves as too far gone. I assure you, if God could bring the Israelites back, He can bring back any individual. So, like Joel in chapter 3, 17 to 21, or Amos 9, 13 to 15, in the prior 2 weeks, Obadiah 21 ends on the high note. God used the mistake of the Edomites as the springboard to restore Jerusalem. If God can repair a nation and land, he certainly has the power to repair and restore individuals. God wants to be our great repairman. What is needed to get the great repairman working on our repairs? First, we have to want his help. We need to ask for his help. Now, I make it sound really simple. And it is. Except sometimes getting our heart out of the way, getting our attitude out of the way, is the most difficult step in that journey. In the Gospels, in Matthew 9:12 and Mark 2:17 and Luke 5:31, is related the story of Jesus saying, "It is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners." For the purposes of what we're talking about today, I might rephrase that just a little bit. I have come to call those with mistakes, unpleasant labels, or just those who need reassurance. The perfect don't need me. If you need help, if you want help, this could be your time to come and respond and make your need for the great repairman to be known as we stand and sing.